So first, an apology, I'm sorry to use the phrase Webster.
I wonder if you can turn off those lights that are like right, there's something that's like really.
That can turn off too, like.
Looking up.
There.
Yeah.
But in this context, it has some utility, use that buzzword. So first, I'm gonna just do a short history of UIs. The first digital computer, this UI had a few problems. It was really slow. Took them about 2 years to build this, and it didn't work. There's two things you want to avoid. The first, like, functioning digital computer was ENIAC, one of the first. And this also had a slow UI. I think these women are essentially assembly programming by changing relays, but it did work, so you rarely get a log table and stuff like that for voice. Kind of first modern user interface was punch card, keyboards and punch cards. Throughout the 60s. Here's your first modern development system, Unix shell, like a great text-based user interface. Similar to this is the 3270. This is probably the first end user interface for a computer that, like, most people could use. It supported, you know, there was some selects, I think, and some data validation for these fields. If you go to AAA, they still use this. Kaiser,
nice.
A lot of times they still use it. These are still widely used, these kinds of interfaces. Here's the apogee of the text-based programming interface, Emacs. It's, you know, to this day, it's pretty much the same text-based interface with sports windowing and all kinds of built-in features.
Hmm. Nobody's shocked that this is still used.
Here's the first mass market windowing interface that, you know, revolutionized interfaces for end users, 1984, and by the mid 90s, just have out of control, like what you see is what you get, selects, mm-hmm. and all kinds of widgets and stuff, and very sophisticated user interfaces. So basically, kind of a steady evolutionary process. And it just all goes to hell. The web browser. So web browsers are just like traditional web browsers are really crappy user interfaces. This is like from the late 90s. This is pretty fascinating. Check this out. It was like so the problem is that HTML is lame. It's just it has very primitive UI support. There's just a couple like selects and text box. There's no dialog support. I call it a click and wait UI, so you just type in stuff and click and then wait a while and you get a new screen. You gotta, you know, see the screen being updated as, you know, when you make your changes. And there wasn't really, developers were basically stuck with this because JavaScript was very poorly implemented and supported until the mid-2000s, let's say. You could use Flash and Java, and many kind of end-user specialized applications use that. But that has its whole host of problems. So that's why most people didn't use that approach. So that's where the web browser was, you know, about 3 years ago, basically just a standard HTML form-based user interface. 2008, Donna and Jim encouraged Tim and I to start using JavaScript, kind of all baby steps. And then an example of that is just this very lame kind of open close tracker. So I avoided a page refresh very easily. It's pretty easy to avoid that. And then Tim started I call it subtrack setting widget. I don't know what Tim called it. But this is an HTTrack UI. It's now become this huge, very complicated user interface to pick subtracks and especially code tracks. And simultaneously, Steve and Zach and others wrote the Cancer Browser UI extensively using JavaScript. And I saw Steve give a demo of this like mid-2008. They were using this jQuery liner and immediately started using it in the Genome Browser.
Could you tell me again what the URL for your PowerPoint is?
Sure.
Sorry. Oh no. I'm sorry, I should have written it down.
Yeah.
So
basically the web user site presentation slash
presentation.
what is Web 2.0? This phrase that everybody uses all the time. So here's Mark's definition. This is a great definition. So Web 1.0 is 3270 with colors, which is really spot on. And Web 2.0 is client server, like modern client server, but it's a really hard to program. And hopefully this is the part that we're trying to eliminate, that hard to program. This is the received kind of more standard definition. So like three things. You use JavaScript to improve your user interface. You use Ajax, which is essentially it's the client. Your client side code talking with a server behind the scenes, so the user doesn't really see that happen, doesn't initiate that. And then web services, so that's where you provide APIs that you use internally and also possibly third parties use the API. So these are APIs that are available to clients over the internet. What is JSON? I'm going to be talking about this a lot. So it stands for JavaScript Serialized Object Notation. It's essentially it's a way to represent JavaScript objects in text files. The very simple language supports three types: arrays or lists and hashes. Sometimes we call these dictionaries. It's basically the de facto standard for interchanging data between JavaScript programs and servers. So, obvious thing to do is JSON versus XML. So, example of JSON. This is like the canonical customer data record. So these are, it's essentially a hash. So here's your keys, and here's your values. There's some text values, there's a number. But the values can also be nested hashes or dictionaries. And you can also, the values can also be lists. So this is a nested hash, there's a nested list, which in turn has some hashes in it. This, it's very easy to read this, and it looks a lot like the way the data is represented. Compare that with XML, XML is just really wordy. So you get all these closing tags. There's not really a clean way to represent lists in XML. There's more than one way to do it, so you can, instead of having a hash, you can use attributes to store values, and that gets kind of confusing. And it really just doesn't look like an object representation. So that's why people use JSON most of the time. So JSON has a ton of advantages. Parsing is built into all JavaScript implementations. It's much more succinct, it's much easier to read. A couple of disadvantages is XML has just lots of little features, like you can embed binary data, for example. You can't do that in JSON. XML can refer to other XML objects in one XML object. There's all kinds of stuff in XML that JSON doesn't have. And JSON doesn't have built-in schemas, but I don't really care about that, but some people really like to use schemas. And that's a way to have a syntax that describes the semantics of your data, so like what a phone number can look like and stuff like that. There isn't a built-in way to do that with JSON. The way people use JSON, this isn't really a problem. So here's an example from JBrowse. This group was here 2 months ago and they gave a demo of their browser. And their browser is pretty intriguing because it's all written in JavaScript and the data is all stored in these static files, JSON files, that the client just retrieves as it needs to. So you can just type in this URL and get a very large piece of JSON that represents the CPG islands for Chrome 1 and HG19. And you can just look at it and kind of figure it out. Like, here's the actual data. This is, I think, the Chrome start. There's a histogram. This is quite long. This is how they draw the histograms on the client side. So this is like a classic. This is a real-world example of somebody using JSON. And again, in JBrowse, it's all... their data is all just, it's all stored in JSON. And a third party could use this. So if we figure this out, we could use this to show tracks as well if we wanted to. So I alluded to jQuery earlier. So when you use JavaScript is a pretty small language. There isn't that many built-in features. So most people use a library to add whatever features you want. Just like in C++, you use STL, that kind of thing. So there's many, many libraries out there but jQuery is a recently developed one that's become very popular. And it has a lot of nice advantages. It hides a lot of the cross-browser differences. This is the problem that like is the bane of JavaScript programmers. They used to have to spend a lot of time dealing with very trivial differences between IE6 and IE7, that kind of thing. And this jQuery pretty much hides all of that, which is awesome. It has a lot of built-in functionality, like AJAX is supported, which isn't that big a deal. It's very easy to do that manually, but it has built-in support for a bunch of stuff. Very active user community, so there's hundreds of widgets. Like I've used several of them already to improve the browser. This is a huge advantage. And there's a lot of people using it. So as new browsers come out, there's pretty much always a new version of jQuery that supports the new browser, which is a big advantage. Another kind of interesting thing about jQuery is it has this syntax to pull out DOM elements. So often in a client-side HTML program, you're just pulling stuff out of the DOM, which is a in-memory representation of the page. And like in this example, I'm pulling out all the map items that are not in the ideomap. The ideomap is the ideogram map. So I'm pulling out all the map items for the HTML tracks, and I'm applying this function to them. This is something you do a lot in a client-side program, so it's nice to have the syntax to do that. So like if you look at the cancer browser code, you see a lot of this kind of stuff. This is kind of lispy. It's also like R has a similar syntax. It's not even functional programming. So now some actual examples. The first way I use jQuery and JavaScript in general for a real application would be just drag select. So this is where you just drag atop the HTML tracks image to select something visually. This Hiram suggested this to me, and it's just many people wanted this. This is ideal version of JavaScript. There's no way you could do this in traditional HTML program, because you'd have to, I don't even know how you do it. You'd have to request a new image every time the mouse moved or something. I don't really think it would be possible to do it. You have to use JavaScript to do this. Some issues specific to this feature. HTTrax is really crowded, so currently you have to select the top, and often you want to just select anywhere, so I'm open to suggestions for how to do that. It's technically kind of challenging because there's all these other stuff in there that you can get by clicking. So that's an open issue to fix. More generally, we had a browser problem with this feature about a year and a half ago. There is a new version of this rendering image that's used by Chrome and Safari that just had basically this feature broke. And there wasn't, I would have had to do extensive development to work around that bug. So we just had to turn the feature off for people with this browser. And luckily, one of our users complained to the team and they fixed it because one of our users wanted this feature so much they complained about it. But this is the problem with using JavaScript is that if there's a browser, it's more likely to have browser problems than with just straight HTML, because it's just the nature of the beast. So a more recent feature that I use JavaScript to do is this gene's search box. So this is where you type in the prefix for a gene, it just gives you a list of all the genes and start with that. This is something I just did on my own because I was tired of searching for TP53 20 times a day, getting a search page, and then clicking on one of them. So it's something I wanted. And I was going to do like a history or something, and that didn't work very well. And then I talked to Dent about it, and he said, hey, just do a Google style select suggest. And light bulb went off, and that's the right way to do it. It took a few days of development to do this. It was pretty simple to do. And within a week, 10,000 people, we're getting 10,000 hits within a week. So clearly something that's useful, and the UI is really obvious. I think that's a key. Anytime you do anything in UI, that's a good sign. People just figure out how to use it without really telling them how to use it. This is a representative of your classic AJAX app. The second gene search box. So by that I mean this is a lot of text. I'll just show a picture, which is probably more illustrative. So the user types in something, and then some client-side code gets notified of that and sends a request behind the scenes to the CGI in our server, and that just uses this prefix and just gets a list of genes and starts with that, responds with some JSON that has the gene names and then the positions of those genes. And that goes back to the client, and then the client-side code gets this, parses out the gene names, and sticks it in a list. And when they pick one of these, it uses this value to populate the position box. So it's classic AJAX, but it's all happening behind the scenes. The user doesn't know any of this is happening. And there's no, as far as the page is not resubmitted. Just thought it'd be useful to share some actual JavaScript. So this is the little function that gets called when the user types something. And it's the meat of this is this AJAX request that's constructing a URL, which is essentially this URL that you see here. So it constructs that on the fly using the prefix that the user has typed. And then this is asynchronous, so it gives this callback and then it returns, and then the user still can use the browser. There's no, as far as the user is concerned, there's no network I/O happening. When the server then responds asynchronously, the browser calls this callback, and that gets triggered and parses out the text and populates the select and so on. So if the network connection gets cut because you're on an airplane or whatever, you lose your Wi-Fi, the user doesn't really see anything. They just see the fact that there's no select box, but they can continue to use the user interface, which is a key thing you want to do when you're doing this kind of design. So just to restate that, there's kind of two kinds of JavaScript. The client-side only, so this is just this drag select is an example of that. There's no network I/O, it doesn't need any information to do that. You can do it all on the client-side. You can unplug your internet connection and you can still do that. And then an AJAX-style application where you need, the code needs to talk to the server to get data. And because of that, you have to keep that in mind when you're programming. You don't want to lock the user. Ideally, you don't want to lock the user out while you're doing this. You, the programmer. So after the JBrowse people came here, I realized there's another way to do this gene search box, which is maybe something that people do a lot, which is just you could, instead of using a CGI on the server side, you can just have static files per assembly that have this that JSON list for every known gene. When the client loads, it can just load this whole file, which is that meg, but it'll be cached after the first time. And then you can just do all the lookup on the client side. And that's the model that JBrowse uses. So the advantage of that is there's no delay. This initial delay, I don't think the user would even see, right? What's that?
I mean, he'd be surprised. Meg can take a while.
Yeah, right, so there could be a delay. That's a good point. It gets cached, so from then on in that browser session, it won't ever get loaded. But that is a disadvantage of this approach. And there's no CGI hits, so it reduces load on the server because all of the logic is done on the client side. So the cons are client side code is more complex because it has to maybe make a B-tree out of this or index it somehow to do a quick lookup. And the build environment is more complex, this is an issue in our build environment, because to add static files, you gotta, the rigmarole, you gotta put them somewhere, you gotta push them to round robin, HTW beta, and all that stuff. So that is a downside to that for us. Okay, so now I'm calling this the pure AJAX app. So this is like modern applications like the cancer browser, all the modern email applications. It's all done on the client side. So there isn't a form, like a traditional HTML form that gets submitted to the browser, to the server. Almost all the user interface is done through JavaScript running on the client side. So this is, the pros of this is you basically get a better UI. It's more like a normal application, like Word or whatever. Another nice advantage of this is forces you to separate your UI and your data so that you can plug in different UIs. So you could write a UI in some other language on the iPad or whatever. You could write an X Windows interface because the data is all going through JSON, which any program application could use. It also makes it easier for third parties to use your data. So like in the JBrowse example, we could use their tracks because they make it, they're totally open to us to use. Cons for us, we have a lot of UI code that's already server-side generated HTML. Like, would you really want to rewrite HD tables, for example? So we have many man-years embedded in all that code, so that's an issue. You don't necessarily want to throw that away just to get possibly a better UI. History is more complicated in these kinds of applications because there's no back button doesn't do anything. You didn't do a form submission. This isn't necessarily a bad thing. This back button often doesn't work in the Gnome browser either. So the other thing is often the back button becomes less important because you often do things via like modal dialogues or that kind of thing where you don't. To get back, you just close the dialogue. And lastly, you can have performance issues if you're trying to render on the client side. Steve may have thoughts about that, but JavaScript is not going to be as fast as code running, C code running on a server. But also, if there's a lot of data, you're moving it back and forth between your client and server over the internet. That's going to be much slower than. Obviously, than doing it via the local file system. Mm-hmm. Okay, so an example of a pure AJAX app is a cancer browser. So, like for example, when you've got a feature settings and you pick your feature and you generate statistics, this isn't a form submission. This just runs some local JavaScript on a client and that sends a request to the server and that. Eventually it comes back with this image and then the client side code pushes this image here. So when all that's happening, you can still use the Gnome cancer browser to look at other data. So it's all being done behind the scenes. There's no, this page never changes. They never get a new HTML for this whole page. Another example is Steve's bio integrator. This is all done via JavaScript. I'm actually gonna show you just a make this kind of real. I'm going to show you using the file integrator. So I'm going to use Firebug, so I'm going to turn on this mode so I can see the network traffic coming back and forth. I'm going to reload this page. And at the bottom, you see there's these three requests that the client side code made. And the last one, I'll open it up, and it's some JSON. And then if I just click here, I can see the JSON as JavaScript object. And these are, it's pretty clear what these are. These correspond to these rows up here, and they're details about, this is P21, so the data is the, I think, expression data for P21 in these however many number of patients, and that's what's being shown up here by the client-side code. So again, this is all done on client-side. How do you actually render? Are these just divs?
They're just divs with background colors, yeah.
Yeah, so Steve's client-side code is just putting some divs on the screen that have colors and stuff there. But the data, it's all driven by this data that he got from the server. And this is actually a cool thing to do with these apps. You just run Firebug and just see the network traffic going back and forth. That's how I figured out what JBrowse is doing. And all similarly, if you get a histogram, again, that's like, let's say I want to get a histogram for the estrogen receptor data, click on this button. That's Steve is generating this histogram on the client. He's using the data that he already fetched from the server. And as you can see, you can get some pretty nice UIs doing this. And it's totally, there's no delay at all. It's happening. There's nothing going, no communication with the server.
What slide are we on now?
What number is it? I don't know what number it is, but it's the bio-integrator slide. Okay, so some features that Tim and I are working on right now. Some of these have been under construction for a year, but we're
Tim now has more time to spend on this, and so do I, so we should have you that first. So track search, this is, it's gonna let you search for tracks using, you know, a search interface. This is a nice example of Ajax. So this is the advanced screen, so you can pick the metadata. This is in code specific metadata. So you can pick a cell, and when you pick this selected get cell, it just populates this with all the cells, cell types that have been assayed in the ENCODE data. And then if you change that to antibody, the client-side code just makes a request to the server and gets a different list of the antibodies that are, have been assayed and changes the select so you can pick the antibody. So that's another classic kind of Ajax-y thing. Context menus, this is so you can right click on a track to hide it. If you hide it, it's instantaneous. It just changes the display to hide that part of the image. If you change the visibility, behind the scenes does an Ajax request to get a new track just for that track. And then when it has, it, when it gets it back from the server, it just populates that. But while that's happening, the user can scroll around and continue to use the rest of the browser. Zoom to, it's actually kind of a nice feature. So these are all bed items. So this lets you zoom to the whole item. So if it's a gene, you zoom out to the whole gene, or some other annotation like a ChIP-seq peak or something, it'll let you just zoom immediately to that feature. This is similar. This is a settings dialog. So you right click and you get a dialog. Instead of going through the HTTrack UI, you just get a mortal dialogue, so you can move this to see the underlying wiggle. And if you don't want to change anything, you just hit escape and you go back to the original page. So there's no back button. As opposed to now, if you go through the HTTrack UI, often you don't, you decide you don't want to do anything, you hit the back button, and then the whole page is rendered, which takes, you know, 5 seconds or so. And Tim, it was hard to show this visually, but Tim is working on a, basically already has a feature where you can just drag and move tracks to reorder them, which is really awesome, and also a panning feature where you can kind of do Google Map style panning. So to drill down on the API side, so I'm experimenting with, I just added this, this CGI, which is called HG API, and it's to provide just, it's a CGI that's just, it's solely to provide a JSON for either internal or external applications that want it. So if, currently I support getting a track list and getting metadata. The track list is something that Steve is experimenting with in the cancer browser. I'll just show that quickly. This would be a tool that lets you turn on track. So this is a, I'm turning on track that is a, this is a cancer browser track, so that's why it's a heat map. And then if you scroll down, there's a, he used that API to get a list of all the, I can just actually search. So these are all the tracks that are about has an alpha, and if you turn these on, it'll add that track to this display. Steve's been busy with his advancement, so it doesn't actually add anything right now, but it'll be fairly easy for you to do that. So that's an example where a third party could use these APIs to get metadata and, you know, display stuff similarly to the way we display it in the genome browser. And this get metadata is it's an API that track search I showed you is using to get the metadata for cell or antibody or whatever the ENCODE metadata. This is actually an example. So you can type this URL in. This will give you a track list in some JSON form. This is a HG API, and then with the assembly, and then whatever the command is.
So metadata, define metadata in this context?
Yeah, it's not, well.
Is there a?
But the metadata, that is, it's really should be called maybe ENCODE metadata. So it's
right.
Like
so it's
cell.
Strictly to the ENCODE project, with the ENCODE definition of metadata,
yeah.
Which is well defined,
yes.
For ENCODE.
You have to have certain types of metadata, right, okay.
It is, like, I don't know if it's constrained in that the antibodies are constrained. Actually, they are.
I mean, is this being driven off of the MetaDB table?
Yes.
Yeah, and that one is intended to perhaps someday expand beyond ENCODE, but it's not.
Yes, exactly.
Not there.
We could put non-ENCODE.
It'd be wonderful if every track had
a
defined place to look for metadata about
like
that.
Like the cell type antibody.
There was some universal definition of metadata, I guess.
Yeah.
Some tracks might not fit into that.
Yeah, like the ENCODE metadata, there's like 30 kinds, or like lab, but then there's like protocol.
That's pretty generic for all, I mean,
all
of our tracks could have some kind of lab of origin.
Definitely antibody, cell type, lab, maybe.
Antibody wouldn't make sense for a lot of them, but I mean, these are just fields
right.
that are,
these are things
that you can have.
Yes, not necessarily there.
That are required, right. Yeah.
Okay, so future direction. So one direction would be just having richer RPC JSONs in the base that perhaps third parties could use. Some of these, like get track images, this requires refactoring of our code because currently our code is just pumping out HTML and to standard out. So to do this, you really have to not do that. You have to keep the data in memory and some kind of in-memory representation, and then at the end you have a fork where you either print out HTML or JSON. So that's an issue for like HTTP tracks. Currently it would take some work to get it to put out the appropriate data as JSON, because currently it's just printing out a lot of standard out as HTML.
And we're talking here about just what the user has requested to see. I'm just sorry, I've lost the context of this.
Get track images, like Steve would like to use that to get a track image for Hudson Alpha, TAF 1.
But this is all in a specified user context. They've specified a genome, they specified a region of the genome.
Possibly. It may be cart driven, or it could just be all the parameters could be provided in this call. You could say, specify the assembly, the genomic coordinates.
Okay. All right.
And then you'd have just the generic height and all. You'd have the default heights,
okay.
Et cetera.
Okay.
You could do it in the set context of a cart as well.
Okay.
Which is more complicated for third parties probably. But in fact, I'm currently basically doing this in the context of the cart when you with the right click menu when you change from visibility settings. That is, I'm using essentially this, and it is using the user's cart. But currently I'm doing it in a very hokey way. I'm basically scraping out HTML. So it'd be better to have it.
Well, how much work is this refactoring?
But this actually isn't, I don't know. It depends on how much we want to provide in these APIs. It could be a lot of work. Depends on how much. Like for HT track images, that's probably a couple of days, I think. I don't think it's too bad.
Oh. I've been talking months or a year or something. A couple of days.
As opposed to like the table browser, I have no idea. You'd have to, everything would have to be, it's such a complicated UI that I can't imagine providing that as an object.
It would depend, I guess, what exactly you mean by refactoring. I could see maybe a couple of days if you just were, not disturbing much of the code and kind of only controlling the output rather than everything that gets run, getting it so that it could return five separate image requests and the it's something close to the time that it returns a single request with five tracks. Now that would take some doing.
And I mean, it is like currently the code is just printing the standard out, so I don't.
I mean, you could put a wrapper around it that would extract the text if you were be the image length, I suppose, if you were being ultra minimal, but I don't
know. But it's also like we need the map too now, so We have to change the map code so that it's not printing this in or out. That's like where I hit a barrier when I was trying to do this. I think that code is pretty centralized.
In the image E2 is.
Yeah, it builds the map in memory and then it prints it all out at once, so that, yeah, that would be pretty easy to fix that.
And which are we, right now image V2 is being used by default.
Right.
Right. So, yeah, to simplify, we should.
So
did you already sort of take out the if-defs then?
As far as using image V2, there's if-defs for the panning and drag reorder still in there.
Okay, so some pitfalls. You can denial service yourself, because like here's an example that Todd showed me this cool thing where they're adding a tooltip in an Archaea browser where you scroll your mouse over a bed item and it shows you a tooltip for that. But then it occurred to me, you know, if you're looking at 1,000 DB SNPs and you just go boop, 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 over that, you're making 1,000 requests to the server. So you got to think about that kind of thing. Related to that, like when I first did gene suggest, I let them just type in one letter and then you get a list that's like a couple thousand genes long and it's pretty big. And it doesn't really serve the user much purpose. You just get this huge list of genes starting with A, so I just fixed that by waiting for two letters, and I pretty much got this down to about a 1K average. So often it's easy to work around these issues, but the tooltip, I don't
really possible.
Know.
You just have to put a sleep after every tooltip is brought up, so it will wait a specific amount of time.
But then it's kind of like an annoying UI, because you're like, as you go over the image, you're like not getting instant feedback about it.
It's possible to do it. It's slow enough that I do it, tested it by scrolling up and down on pages, which made the thing really slow until you put a sleep in there, a timeout in there.
Right.
And after that, it becomes long enough that you won't denial of service yourself, but short enough that you don't have to wait forever for the thing to.
Yeah, so that, you know, there's ways to work around these, but it's a client server app. It's not running locally, so you have to keep that in mind. You're totally dependent on JavaScript, so you could just totally fail on a new browser, so that your exposure to that is much higher. I'll talk about that one in a second. Currently, HTTrax is pretty slow, so if you're doing anything that depends on HTTrax, it's going to be a problem, especially if you're calling it a lot. And one way around this is through static files, so like if you just want the tracks for that assembly, that's something that doesn't change. You know, that only change when you make HTTrax, so you could have it as part of your build process. But other things like requesting a new image is dynamic, so it's got to be done by that dynamic process. If your APIs are public, you can't arbitrarily change them. So that adds some overhead, perhaps considerable overhead. We talk about supporting the top browsers that are used by 5% of users or more, so that's currently six browsers, these six browsers, including 96, which is still more than Chrome, almost as much as Safari. So you really should have a process where somebody regularly tests on 96. I don't think that's done now. So that's, as you use more JavaScript, this becomes much more important, because 96 is just totally crazy different. So that, currently the burden is now six browsers. So that's my talk. I'd like to open it up to like really blue sky about APIs, and if we want third parties using this stuff, and what you think about JBrowse and more static stuff.
One thing I would love to have is a two-pane application with the track controls on a separate page rather than something you have to go to and come back from. I mean, being able to adjust them once they're displayed is nice, but that doesn't help you for turning on tracks.
Right, so rather than scrolling down to the bottom, having that the stuff on the bottom on a separate page.
Yeah, either that or you put it so it displays to a separate page and then you have to click through and click back.
And Steve, so two different windows communicating with each other.
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't even do it in Windows. I mean, that was kind of the idea behind this new mashup browser that I'm making, which is that, you know, the track, actually right now what happens in that is you hit that, right now the arrow just turns on the tracks, but ideally the arrow will actually flip over to the track controls that are all in the drop down and maybe some other settings along with that. And then you have a region on that left side that actually shows all the active tracks are actually shown. Unfortunately, the resolution is not great on
Larry's right side.
Right next to the positional thing, there's a few, the tracks that are active are listed, but which you can't see because you'd have to scroll over to the right. But I was thinking maybe move those to the top and the left or something. I don't, I guess it's, if you mouse over it, maybe it'll refresh or something. It's just some weird display thing. Anyway, it's trying to be smart about the window size. So. But
you could have this, like a little thing you drag this to make this smaller.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and if you hit the X up there, it right now it condenses up and flops over. So, I mean, there's some control for stuff like that, but to be able to have that same, yeah, I mean, I totally agree having the two panel thing is a really useful feature because scrolling to the bottom every time is not great because you kind of...
Yeah, you lose your context.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you played at all with any of the hierarchical lists in jQuery?
No.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, that's, someday I'd like to sort of get the tracks and subtracks and supertracks all so that they
Oh, so like a widget to show hierarchical lists. Yeah, those are usually called grid controls. I've seen some. Mm-hmm. I think that's what you mean. Kind of like a finder. There's a bunch of them. I mean, that's one problem with jQuery. There's like 20 different.
It's not in core. There's 30 different ways.
There's like everybody and their brother is doing it. So you have to spend some time. Usually, I spend time just trying a lot of them, knowing what I need to use. It's not like using X Windows or that kind of thing, where there's a couple ways to do it.
I mean, you envision ultimately like providing a set of JavaScript objects to interact with these things in back from like
like a library?
Yeah, almost like a library that interacts.
That's a good idea. Like getting a track list. That's a great idea. I could wrap some of the screen scripting.
Well, hopefully we can get rid of that.
Yeah,
it's supposed to wrap.
That'd be one way to.
I just think it'd be nice. I mean, so the idea of like these mashups was kind of a couple of years ago, and some people are still doing it with Google Maps and stuff like that, you know, pulling in data from various sources. But, you know, I mean, this ultimately may solve some of our security problems from dealing with having to pull data from various servers that have specific security limitations. I mean, not that we should ever fully implement security on the front end, but having the ability to pull up data from various sources just through some sort of listener pages, like APIs, even if they are JSON formatted. I mean, this was an idea that Jim presented, you know, 6 months ago and probably presented since then, but these data sources can be just as simple as JSON listener pages that you have a well-known API, you know, and sit in various remote locations.
And then we get people to run those for us?
Well, if people want to run a version that hosts their data, great. If people want to lock down a version with a password, great. It's just you write a client. We have a client-side thing that knows how to interact with.
And does those like a JSONP?
Yeah, just do JSONP. I mean, we need obviously the security.
So they log in with the browser essentially, because they've logged in with their browser. JSONP will work.
Yep.
It seems like you want to get away from doing that kind of stuff at all. I mean, just if you're using JavaScript, just make, have them host everything, kind of like, well, yeah, the all the data should be on their machine. And so if you have this stuff, I mean, it takes some JavaScript to get the stuff to show, but do it like JBrowse does it and make it so that all the processing would take place on the client side. Because I don't see how you're going to get any sort of decent security if you're moving anything to your server and back.
Well, HTTPS, and there's tons of open source.
Well, it's still on your server. I mean, that's sort of the point, was I thought that even people running the, you avoid keeping off your server entirely.
Well, that's what Steve is saying. It'll be on the
yeah, like for instance, we have a huge problem where we need NCBI to host this data.
Right.
If we can give them a binary where it's like, here's, you know, I mean, obviously the authenticating to that binary is some issue, but you know, once you've authenticated to that thing, now you have, it's like a single sign-on genome browser. The genome browser knows, okay, if you're authenticated with NCI, just go make a JSONP request over there for the track image.
I mean, it could also just be static.
I've got a UI question for, I mean, so it's a common theme where you sort of push, you know, you do something that invokes an asynchronous request, and things, you know, typically work if that request is instantly serviced. I would say, like, similar to the plain CGIs tend to work when you get like a two second or less response time, and then past that it starts getting, people start noticing increasingly. Is there, but you can't always guarantee that you're going to do that, and especially if you're making requests, you know, for large amounts of genome data.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some sort of standard UI for sort of showing that something's been requested, and that, you know, just to keep the user from pressing the button again? You know?
In my tree, I added, like, when you click here, those little spinning button appears here,
yeah.
And it goes away when you get this.
Uh-huh.
That's often what people do.
Yeah, if it's something that's going to take up positional size on the page,
mm-hmm.
people try to find, either set that width ahead of time and throw like a loader bar or like a fake spinny in the middle to show
yeah.
that there's something happening, and then prevent the request from happening again. You can disable the button, gray out the button. There are some UI conventions that say don't use this button anymore because it doesn't work. But as far as just to show that something is going to be appearing, it's generally a fixed width thing that you throw some sort of spin.
So like when you're redoing the, I don't know how far you are, with the right click stuff, when you were going to change something from, say, you know, dense to full or something like that.
Yeah, stuff like that's difficult because it requires knowing the size of the element.
I just put up a watch cursor now.
You put up a watch cursor?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you can still scroll and use the UI, but the watch cursor the cursor has changed until I get the new track. It might be better to put maybe a little looping thing next to the track or something.
Yeah.
The loopy thing, I mean those little bars.
Spin bars.
In the cancer browser, they have this bar. That
right.
Spins. When you turn on a track in the cancer browser, it's going to appear, it has this bar until you get the track. It's definitely an issue, because like this can take a couple of
seconds. If you change the cursor, it's not so easy to change the cursor all over the screen.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can lose track of the fact.
Yeah,
right?
I think the spinning bars are better.
But if you wanted to block everybody out and change the cursor, then I added a little JavaScript thing to do that. But, right, if it's something asynchronous, it's going to come back. You need to be able to handle the case when it, for some reason, it doesn't come back. So.
Yeah, we put up a little message in the file.
Yeah. And how, I mean, how in general do you test that?
Well, it should be tested across all those browsers, the six browsers.
Right, so that's one thing is that this, it does potentially add to the testing burden, and in particular, I guess there's there's the six browsers that you want to test in, but also, I guess the asynchronous fail is...
Just turn off your Wi-Fi.
Yeah, but you have to turn it off at precisely the right time. So, in a lot of cases, because, or, you know...
Usually, well, what do you mean, otherwise it will...
Well, maybe you don't, but I guess just...
That's what I usually do. I mean, you'll get it. There's a timeout usually, 10 seconds later, the request fails.
Okay.
We handle it maybe in a hokey way. We just put this message on the top of the window. That's an issue. Maybe we should use alerts. I don't know. No.
Absolutely not.
It's hard to say.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
I guess that's part of why I'm asking. It's just to see.
Well, there's
Because you start getting into exception process. I guess one of the keys to making an application robust is to limit the number of paths through it. And so, you know, there's been, and I guess I'm, you know, in some ways, you know, I would definitely rather just put up an error than to necessarily try to recover from it, but I don't know.
Right, you could store the parameter that you used to do the request and do it again.
And I guess you can get in such situations where, I don't know, you've done some alteration to the page with the initiation of the request and then more when it's coming back, or I guess stylistically you could perhaps try to defer as much as possible to the actual get the response back.
Usually before the response you just put up these spinners. Mm-hmm. So you can get these spinners stuck there if it fails. But then if the user reinitiates the action, the spinner will go away once you, if it succeeds, when they reinitiate.
I see.
Or you can hide the spinner. I don't think we really but you could hide the spinner and it failed as well.
Yeah.
I killed the spinner.
Put a little broken thing there or something. Sometimes people do that.
Okay. Anyway, that's nice.
Do you think we should have these open APIs?
Well, I guess that there's, I think in general probably the answer is yes, but it's, as you say, it is a bit more work and you know, there's going to be degrees where I think inevitably you're going to be inconveniencing some third party, well, I don't know. There, maybe the worst case is you go to the trouble of you know, making the third-party APIs and documenting them some and all that, and then nobody uses them. But that's probably, I don't think that would entirely happen. Then, you know, the next case is that, you know, you find then that you've boxed yourself in somewhat, but I don't know. At this point, the code does tend to change relatively slowly. Could you put up a little bit more about the one you've got already for the track, getting the settings? The get track list, rather.
Oh, put up the example.
Okay, so that's what it's returning.
Yeah, so like I'm not including all that stuff about limited viz and all those.
And you're not including the settings?
No. Yeah, that's a... Like when you do these APIs, you have to choose how much to put there.
Yeah, I mean, this response already on HE18 is pretty large for a JSON response.
Yeah, that's an issue. Yeah. But, and like, it doesn't have that limited viz stuff that you really do need if you're going to have our current interface to.
And then the code that's doing this is basic, is actually, yeah, what's the code that then responds to this? I guess the HG API, it's just doing a lookup of the TrackDB database table?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
That's the email I sent you asking about. yesterday. It's not getting all the tracks, but it's using HGTrack TV and it's going down through the children. Similar code that's used.
So HGTrack TV, or do you mean the Track TV table?
No, it's using the, there's a.
Oh, there's the call, the function call for it.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's in HDB.c, I think.
Yeah. In some ways, it'd be nice to, I don't know, it might even be nice to hook up TDB query somehow to this. Because, yeah, you've got four out of, you know, this is four fields, which are probably four relatively interesting ones to a lot of people, but I guess it does suffer in that, you know, I can imagine a lot of cases that wouldn't care about all four and could be smaller, and other cases that really would want more.
Yeah, then you can do this game
but
where you add little
yeah.
flags to,
Some APIs force you to specify anything above the minimal. You provide maybe track as the default singular value, and then you're forced to specify any other parameters you want through the get var
right.
or whatever. Right.
Or yeah.
Kind of almost like a select query at that point. You're just specifying what selects you want.
I see. Yeah, this one, I guess if you were to do the whole TDB query thing, then you'd be forced to go beyond the database tables. And I think the TDB query time may be, I mean, my feeling is something like this, is you're wanting definitely a sub-second response.
Yeah, right now this takes 1.6 seconds.
Really? Okay.
But that's also receiving 800K worth of text for that track list. So there may be a way to compress that down into something.
Yeah.
Cheese a bit.
Yeah, you can do that, yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, that would be an advantage of having your static files too.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty easy to do that. This is static data, theoretically.
Yeah. I guess I don't know. I have somewhat mixed feelings about the, I guess having large static JavaScript things. You were talking a little bit about, you know, the they've got chromosome one for, you know, broken up a chromosome at a time for the CPG islands.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I think that seems like it's going too far, but I don't know, some of the things were, you know, the metadata and the track lists and stuff like that, potentially, you know, that seems like it could be reasonable.
Can I go back to the security issue briefly? This is a break. So this seems to me a very, very striking and important application that's very immediate. We have two people at NIH that we are now kind of working with. One is Jim Ostell, and the other is Ari Khan. One's at NCBI and one's at NCI. They both have data that is of limited access because it's full genome data. It's large and of limited access. And we, you know, we increasingly need to work with it, and our current solution is to go through an arduous process of downloading it, and then we're building up security. We're paying extra money now to get firewalls and so forth set up here, but we're all acknowledging that in the long run, we can't keep downloading all the terabytes of genome data that's going to be made available at NCBI. So I think it would be great as soon as possible to try to come up with some small test explorations. So Ari put some TCJ data up at NCBI in a format that our interface can actually get to. And and we try that both from a security and from a data exchange viewpoint.
Would
try to do something differently.
Would they be willing to put on a web server that the person would log into?
That's what I mean. That's what it would have to be.
Yeah,
I think they would be willing to.
If Ari said to me personally, he's happy to work with us on this.
Well, if they did that, then you could use this JBrowse approach where the person uses a browser to log in using whatever authentication that they NCBI provides. And then
we're going to be, in the short run, we're going to be dealing with two different authentications, an NCI authentication and an NCBI authentication.
Well, theoretically,
but they have to worry about that.
They have to do that.
So that's great. So let them worry about that.
And then, but then we would have to do this kind of client-side implementation.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Which, I mean, JBrowse did it, so it's not.
Well, you know, I think it would be great just to start to get some experience with that. That has enormous value to me in my book, given that, you know, the earlier you have experience, the better you are prepared for the inevitable here, which is that we will be getting a lot of our data this way out of NCBI, or out of NIH, I should say.
See the future.
Oh, well, I mean, I think that we could. You're probably more familiar with this approach. I'm not, and the data maybe isn't changing, but it seems like it's difficult. The amount of data we're talking about is difficult to represent in these kind of flattish files, and so it might be easier for us to give them some sort of binary that knows how to process the data into something that the browser can use, because the browser is not going to care about every single band position when it goes to draw a picture.
Give
you know?
Them a binary that runs, gives like.
We probably have to have a lightweight browser, even very similar code without all that tables that come with the browser, just a lightweight code. And we can give them the data, we can deposit to DCC the way.
Well, that's, I mean.
After we process.
No, we don't, well, we don't want the job of downloading all their data, processing it, and then uploading it back to them just so they can display it. There's ways that, you know, like Larry's HDAPI thing, I mean, that's basically a thin wrapper around.
Right, so we give them that thin wrapper.
We give them a thin wrapper around some BAM format that knows how to
provide this kind of
data,
yeah.
Yeah, and then
someone
we just, you just make sure that on for them, they need to make sure that it's locked down and secure
right.
enough for them to be okay with it. And we could do it with something that's not sensitive first. So that
oh,
like
of
we
course.
Should do
yes.
it with something that's not sensitive first. So
okay, so in that, if we're doing that in the genome browser, this has been done in the genome browser, cancer browser.
Well, you could
either.
Do it first
the
in
thing.
The cancer browser.
Yeah,
right.
We can we can write a thin client that can just do that, pull up some really simple cancer tracks across various places. I mean, that would be a half a day's worth of JavaScript work, not even so.
Because in the genome browser, we'd have to do work to, because there currently isn't any way to write into a track in that image.
But what's exciting to me is I'm hearing here that some of this work that is prototyped on the cancer browser could be ported to the genome browser. I'm not hearing this clearly, but I'm hearing that the possibility exists so that it isn't, so that we get double benefit from that. Because I'm just that much more excited about something
I think
that would also port to the genome browser.
Well, yeah. And I think, I mean, Larry and I have been trying to work together to provides similar solutions that if someone wants to, you know, they can be ported back and forth possibly. But I mean, there's obviously a lot of work that that's going
to
be.
I think there would be a way to squeeze this into a current image too, right? We just have to have some empty link that then the client side is getting the data and populating. It's just a
adding a row into the table.
Yeah, so that actually probably would be that hard to do. It's just not. And there's no code that's doing that currently in the genome browser. But I don't think it would be that hard to do.
I think enough pieces are maybe in place now to try it at least.
Well, I'm totally excited about this, and if you want me to take a personal approach again to Ari, I told him, you know, we had dinner and he sat next to me at dinner last time, that was a month and a half ago. Talked about this and he's ready to go.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first step is just for us to get a BAM file that is just totally public and throw it up on some of these servers like Jim did with the test before and that he was doing with, or those that you were actually doing with BigWigs, right? The file that, but we can do the same with a BAM and throw it up on a few web servers and just write a really thin server and just kind of ask for it.
A wiggle or something, or
yeah.
Just a histogram.
Yeah. I mean, it's worth a try, right?
It's unbelievable.
So to be clear, you were imagining the remote site. It's going to package the data. It's not creating an image portion.
Well, that's
a
question.
The client
I guess,
side doing the image.
I would argue for the remote side, drawing the image as well.
Okay.
But I don't really know how much code that takes from the Genome Brothers editor.
No, I don't. But,
yeah.
But I think that would be the faster way to get things done.
Yeah, and then you're sending always a static, 100K or whatever the image size is versus a dynamic amount of data that
mm-hmm.
if you're requesting an entire genome may be
right.
unreasonable enough. I don't know that. Drawing on the client side.
Yes.
No
fun.
Yeah. Talk about cross-browser issues.
What have you been experiments been with it lately, I guess?
Well, I've tried, the BioInt UI does all that through in a similar way that JBrowse does, which is just creating divs and with background colors. And then we have a pathway viewer that actually uses the canvas tag, which is similar to sort of SVG.
Mm-hmm.
This is the more browser backwards compatible method. Canvas is a little less backwards compatible. Slow, I mean, it's noticeable, but you can't really beat images, generating the images on the server side right now, unfortunately. You can do some things if you do it intelligently, but you definitely wouldn't get the richness of the images that you're generating right now on the server side, on the client side. In order to get those would require drawing them with the same complexity that you draw on the server side. And I don't think that's a reasonable request of the browser at the moment.
Well, I don't know. With some of this, in some ways, I feel, maybe it. I don't know. It seems optimistic to think that it's 3 days to refactor the code to the browser so that you could effectively have it render one track quickly and effectively, which seems to be what. This is coming around to one more time. I think it's a worthwhile thing to do. I don't know. I think architecturally, you've got a few big pieces. You've got who the what's a user, and connected to the user, you want sort of like a keychain. There are some ways so that they can get access to stuff they're authorized to access. And then you also want associated with them kind of the full UI state, everything they've fiddled with this. And it's interesting. I guess I see, there seem to be a lot of piecemeal things with this. I don't know, in some ways, I don't know. It's interesting to sort of see the, I don't know. I feel like the genome browser is being pulled in three directions this right now architecturally. I haven't really resolved it. I mean, there's a lot of useful stuff that you can do sort of working inside of little bits of the genome browser that you guys have done already. On the other hand, some of it. Some of it has been in construction for a year, and still has to go. And then, I don't know that we have addressed fully the issues of where our QA department really is, or seriously testing it on the 6 browsers that it needs to be tested on, and that the number of codes a pass through the code small enough that it really can be tested. So I don't know, but it seems like there's some hard but worthwhile software engineering, I guess, is what I'm going to say.
Well, so you were thinking of, so if this data is residing in CVI, you want the user to change settings and stuff? Is that what you're
so, thinking? Well, like, I guess this gets down to a little bit what you mean by the API. So one, and I think, you know, there's people with different backgrounds and different visions sort of working on different things here. But one lightweight API I'd like to see is just around the Bigwig and the Big Bam, so that they can give you, you know, they can return just the piece of the data that you're interested in. And if you're zoomed out pretty far, you know, this would include summary information rather than every last line. And I guess that's one. You know, that's one of the design decisions you can make. You can either, you know, if you're not rendering on the client side, then on the server side, then you need to somehow whittle down the rendering task so that it's small enough so that the client side, which is, you know, running at a tenth the speed, can actually do that. And so, and in some ways, this is analogous to what people were doing. If you sort of look at the Perl versus the C implementations, where, you know, the C implementations were only very, very gradually driven into needing to have pre-computed tables elsewhere and that sort of stuff. But
the model C was suggesting, basically they have a Gmail browser running there that's rendering parts of tracks.
So.
Right?
Yeah, I don't want to think of it that heavily, but
that's,
I mean, yeah.
I think really what you were, when I thought
what
about, that would work, actually. We could just ask for one track or two tracks for
right.
The other genome browser using JSON key.
Yes, that's one possibility.
That would be, then we don't have to worry about any of these issues about getting them to.
And I mean, that obviously assumes that they're willing to set up basically the equivalent of a mirror with more limited stuff. I mean, there's an intermediate step, which is some sort of more like thinner drawing thing that knows how to take in things like Wig, Bigwig,
right.
BAM, and render them. I don't know.
That
I
also
mean,
means like the metadata, the track metadata, and stuff like that.
Yeah, once you start rendering, then there's
maybe
there
isn't some intermediary. That's the thing. I don't know.
I mean, the way the current browser works is, you know, you sort of get the track it wants to render, and then you have to bring in, you know, it depends what it is, but probably more often than not, four or five user settings that are controlling the rendering, there's ways around that. You could get explicit with it. I guess that's something that's kind of missing in my mind from this a little bit too. Is if we have a renderer, you know, I'm still kind of assuming that for these JavaScript driven applications that having a client side track renderer is useful, and if that's the case, I guess, you know, figuring out how to get it so that it, you know, renders the way the user wants, ends up sort of making the API pretty fat.
Yeah. Because I'm basically a configuration page has to be driven.
Jim, when you were talking about the idea, I still can't remember the exact lingo for it, but having track databases that were running some kind of light.
Yeah, I think that's more
remote.
What I'm thinking about.
So with that, I wasn't thinking
was
of rendering on. I was not thinking of rendering.
I see.
On those.
So they
it was just basically fetching data.
So the server side here would still go to NCI and say, ask the question versus the client side going to NCI and asking the question.
Right, and there would need to be a little bit of, I guess the client, the server side though would, well, I don't know, the sort of, I think we need to get a good model of sort of, you know, a user object. If there was one thing that we could sort of share, you know, between projects, if it were sort of some sort of a user object that was responsible for both settings and authentication, and that it would be most handy somehow on the session you could sort of forward the authentication, on the server could forward authentication to get to other places.
Yeah, I don't know what NCI is feeling on that.
Yeah, that doesn't sound. I like the idea of having them use the web browser. You don't have to do anything, right? That's all their responsibility. And we don't have to we don't have to cooperate with them in any way.
So that means the client is communicating directly with NCPI to authenticate.
The downside of that, we have to get the data through the client.
So basically,
can't
we
do
need
it through our server.
So
I mean, that's what
you would need to get.
I agree.
You
right.
Need to get basically something capable of rendering running
in
our formats on running on NCBI.
Yes.
Which I think they would be willing to do if it wasn't a huge. I mean, it sounds like they're willing to work with us, and maybe to the.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've even heard some talk of them installing a version of the cancer browser there,
so that we
can.
No, they're certainly, and they would. They would mirror both the genome browser and the cancer browser,
right.
Essentially. I mean, that's in the cards. I just hear that I still continually hear that it's somewhat onerous to set up.
Yeah, I think
mirror.
that's what I'm wondering. Is there some?
So if there was
is there a light?
Great.
Yeah, exactly. Is there a light version that doesn't require all of the database behind? Because you don't need the table browser. You don't need all of the. A lot of the other interactions and other tools on the genome browser, but literally is just like a
that's
list of tracks and a renderer. And
that's basically an installation.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. There's a lot of stuff in the source that has nothing to do with drawing.
That's
why
SQL, and you have to track DB.
Can I ask a question here? I don't know if this is a realistic idea or not, but essentially you're getting some data that's private data, and then you want to render an image from that. We already have means of getting data from BAMs or bigwigs that are located remotely. So is it conceptually realistic to do something like you go to the client goes to the remote site to get the private data, and then some of that data is essentially what is needed to render an image. The client then goes to our server with anonymous data that asks it to convert that into an image, and then the client gets the image back and renders the image. So the data that's going to our server is anonymous and obscure enough that it is not a security issue. Is that a?
I don't think there's ever any level of data that's anonymous enough. That's part of the problem.
Okay.
And that's just too complicated. The client's getting data, sending it from one server, or sending it to us. And then we're sending it to us.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and there's a lot of data.
Right.
Seems to be easier to get them to install a genome browser and render it there. I mean, Hiram, how hard is it to install a genome browser? For you, it takes time.
Well, Hiram, you're actually looking at this in terms of a cloud-type installation of the future with them.
Yeah, you can turn on the genome browser, and you don't have to have all the tables. I mean, there's no need for that, unless you want to look at the track. So, you know, if you don't want to look at the tracks, no, you don't have to install the tables. But the genome browser is not a big deal, really.
Yeah, that's my impression, at least.
Yeah, I guess getting Well, there's, you need to set up MySQL and then,
But see that, but those are things that I wonder if they can be, like the MySQL thing could be abstracted to something like SQLite if you're running on like a really lightweight thing where now you just, your SQLite file is just a database and it's just a thing and it doesn't need MySQL because it's a single track DB thing or a flat file track DB. Mm-hmm. You just remove the database part of it entirely. This, I mean, we're talking as lightweight as you can make it and
right.
By cutting out pieces like MySQL, that will help a lot.
Seems easy.
Jorge had to install SQLite in order to get the CVS server emulator running. I don't think it was so much easier for him. He kind of got a little help from Mark on that.
Well, no, I guess, yeah, I mean, I guess you just moved to flat files then or something. At that point, SQLite and flat files are, I guess what I'm saying is just removing the some of the pieces that are maybe a little bit complex for people that are not used to those admin-y type
Berkeley DB
things.
I get that. I just want to make sure that I'm clear what you're asking. So you're talking about a genome browser that doesn't hit MySQL, instead hits MySQLite.
Well, even to simplify it further, just a genome browser that instead of validating, like finding a track, when you say, give me this track image, instead of going into the track DB tables, it goes into the track DB file. Because it knows almost where to find it, and the track DB file on this remote mirror installation is now 10 tracks instead of 1,000 or however many we have on the genome browser. So it's a reasonable thing to do in a flat file.
Yeah.
And now we've removed, I mean, I don't know what else. I mean, I know the browser does a ton of MySQL queries. But for something like BAM, where the data file is literally a data file anyway, and we draw that from a data file, now you've removed, if you're going to remotely draw a BAM file, and the references in that are all in TrackDB files that you can just look up in flat files, now maybe you don't need MySQL. I don't know, that's a question.
No, I mean, it's true, but it just sort of seems like you're wanting the most complicated parts of the gene. I'm sorry to, seems like you're wanting some of the more complicated functionality of the genome browser and then cut off a few pieces that are hard to install and end up with something that's working. And I don't know. I mean, it seems possible, but it's the sort of thing where,
Well, no, I'm not. Yeah, and that might not even be a big deal at all. And
it's not challenging.
Yeah. Yeah.
It seems not like a big deal. I've done that on my laptop. I mean,
yeah, I'm not sure what the point of this light browser is. What's its purpose?
It draws a single track image. A single track.
But for who does it draw it? Just
it draws it. Anyone that can request it and has met whatever permission parameters that the source says is okay. Like it literally draws what's between the label and the right side of the screen for a single piece of that. And I have only toyed through HTTracks code and I'm by no means an expert, so. Maybe
I don't know. It is pretty. It's just. Overall, it's over a million lines of source now, of which probably a quarter million are touched by HTTracks in one way or another, and I think it's some worthwhile work to get something that will render an image, as light in a quicker way as possible. But it's not going to be, I think we've already been through a few rounds of trying to cut down the startup time. Larry actually did some work on it where you took it, you took some of the string substitutions out and it got down to, and I think now it's down to half a second, and basically, or it was down to about 0.4 seconds. And I think we'd all love to get it down some more, but It's very, very interconnected at this point, and so.
But I mean, if they're running a genome browser and we get 10 banned, you know, we request 10 banned images or something, it's fine if it takes a half second. That's how the genome browser is too, right? So I don't see that's a problem. If we have 10 images in this thing that are actually somewhere else, it's just like
maybe
using the genome browser.
Maybe the small efficient installation is clouding the argument a little bit of having these, just having the benefit of the remote installation in general.
That's what, if you can convince them to install that genome browser, that solves the problem with some developer side. Okay, not that much though.
Is this the cancer?
Okay. Well, anyway. Thanks much for the presentation.
Looks like you guys need to.
Oh, yeah.